our first meeting of the fall session. We have a nice roundup of topics for the rest of the until January. And the Dallas Philosophers Forum has been around for 35 plus years, and we invite speakers, noted experts, or whatever. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? And not just philosophy, but history, science, literature, art, different subjects that are of topical interest, you know, to us now. The forum is a nonprofit, but we do have our expenses, so we charge for admission. See our treasurer, raise your hand, David. It's $5, and if you're a full-time student, only $2. So see David. And if you've ordered food or drink, make sure you take care of it. We don't want to be stuck with the ticket afterward, and make sure that you take care of your server also, please. We have a good lineup coming up, let's see, in September the 27th, In Defense of Plagiarism, Philip Rossman. October 11th, Against Statutes of Limitations, John Harris. October 25th, Growing a New Generation of Social Justice Activists and Agitators. November the 8th, Are the Size and Age of the Universe Evidence Against the Existence of God? That ought to be interesting. November the 22nd, Sun Tzu and Modern Warfare. And December 13th, Religion in the Process. So we have a nice schedule ahead of us, and we should have those printed up. It is on our website, so you can look at those in the future. There will be about a 45-minute or so talk, and then a presentation, and then a Q&A afterward. So without any further ado, I'm going to introduce Jack Yunkin, also a member of our board, who will introduce our speaker.
Thank you, David. Let's see if I can get what I'm supposed to say on my phone. Great. Well, I met our speaker tonight 5 years ago in the summer. We were attending a class on the 12 Steps to Compassionate Life by Karen Armstrong. And so it's only taken me 5 years to get Estelle to come here. But we're glad she's here. And so she began teaching at the University of Dallas in 2013. In her graduate studies, she focused on 19th century and early 20th century European art and women artists, with a special attention given to art education and the development of artist colonies in Europe in the turn of the century. Estelle completed her BA at the University of Dallas with a major in art history and a concentration in French literature. She then attended the Institute of something-something at the Sorbonne, in Paris, France, where she earned her MA and PhD. And then she also, what's this other thing, something plastique, where she studied studio art, whatever that is.
I grew up in Texas. I mean, I'm sorry.
Estelle has taught art history classes at East Hill College and art classes at the Dallas International School and just about every other local university we have in the area. So without further delay and messing up all these French words, Estelle, on to them.
Works. Oh, because you, okay.
If you want to use it, it works.
Yes. Okay, thank you. It's the École d'Art Plastique. It's an art school. It's Okay.
Well, I probably was.
That's fine. And in art education, it was actually a woman art education. I'm thinking, most of the artists that I'm showing today are all male artists. I just realized that. White male artists, so that's interesting. Let's see. So this is going to be very relaxed, so if you want to jump in and ask questions, or because I wasn't sure how to orchestrate this. So first of all, let's just start with the word sublime, which fascinates me. So if you look up the dictionary, the definition is of such excellence, grandeur, or beauty as to inspire great admiration or awe, for example, Mozart's sublime piano concertos. As a noun, the sublime experiences are experiences that range from the sublime to the ridiculous, used to denote the extreme or unparalleled nature of a person's behavior or attitude. This is obviously a more modern dictionary of the word sublime. But then there's the definition of sublime in chemistry that I think is fascinating. It's when there's a change of a substance from the first state to the third without going through the second. So an example would be a vapor going when heated. A solid substance that when it's heated goes directly to vapor without going through the liquid, which I think is really interesting. So if you break down the word sublime, there's also the word subliminal and then the word liminal. Sub, of course, means under, and limen or limen, I'm not sure of the pronunciation, is also another word for limit or boundary or threshold. So with all of this, you can keep all these definitions because, as you can guess, I'm not going to have an exact definition for what the sublime is. I have an idea of what it is to me, and it'd be interesting to see what it is to you, especially after we go through all of these images. And I have quite a few because I went a little slide happy. So let's see. So the first, back in antiquity, the first time we really see the word sublime that's written about is in a text that was thought to be older. Now we think it's around first, AD is BCE, no, CE, excuse me, Common Era, still in my mind, go back. So it's a text by someone that's named Longinus or Pseudo-Longinus. At one point it was also attributed to someone called Dionysius, not Dionysus, but another writer. And that text is actually mostly about poetry and rhetoric. And then Sappho is mentioned as an example of the sublime, but not so much art. And then we have, that text was translated by Boileau, a Frenchman, in 1674. And then Edmund Burke picks it up in 1757. And he writes a philosophical inquiry into the origin of our ideas of the sublime and the beautiful. And then, of course, we have Immanuel Kant, who also refers to the sublime. So I'm actually not going to spend too much time on all of this, but we're going to look at some images because... in all of these different definitions, whether it is by nature, whether it's a work would usually refer to this idea of nature, that you experience something that's beyond, that you cannot explain, that's beyond words. And first time I felt that, I was a girl, and it was in the Louvre. And I don't know if you've been to the Louvre and you've seen the winged goddess of victory, but she's standing above stairs, and she's very large, and I think for me, that gives the best definition is when I want to breathe something in, then that's the sublime, and I have chills just thinking about it. And it's, there's also the notion of fear in it, but it can be also pleasure, and so the fear and the pain, the attraction, all of that is mixed into the sublime. So here we have Nike. Here's the, so she's approximately 8 foot high. She's at the Louvre, and she was meant to be, she was initially, so she's just landing, and she was displayed on top of a mountain, so you could see her from above as she's landing to mark the victory of the battle. So the next example that I have of the Pietà, is the Pietà. And it's awful. It's getting to be more and more that when I look at these images, and I think it's embarrassing to show this flat, small image when you, well, now no, few people can be in front of them. Actually, instead of saying her, I always want to say her, but it's them. But it is an example for me of the sublime. Because in that idea that it's something that is beyond explanation, what Michelangelo does is that he has mastered at the age 20-something, maybe 21, 20, 23, I think, is when he completed it. He has mastered the rules of perspective, and he's able to play with them, and he's able to distort so that we don't actually at first see that it's distorted. So this is an image that was traditionally in the Northern Renaissance, and when you see other images of the Pietà, of Mother Mary holding her dead son, they're usually carved out of wood, and the son is a little weird. He's, of course, quite large, kind of sticking out to the side, and here everything is flowing and natural, and I don't know if you see it in this image, we're not exactly sure how, where she was meant to be at first, but, or see, I think I'm doing it again, she. But she is enormous. If she were to stand up, she's absolutely enormous. And that is the way that she's able to carry her dead son. So not only that, but Michelangelo is also teaching us about the Catholic belief at the time, that she is also, her lap is the altar. So she is not only presenting her dead son, she gave birth to the son, but then she's also holding him as presenting as the sacrificial lamb. I have a student at Eastfield who does not write very well, but she can see. And this is for me where the sublime enters. And this is why I'm using this as an example. We can probably turn this guy off because he's not happy. So she went to the, they have a museum assignment at Eastfield, and they need to go to a museum and see a work of art. So she went to the Biblical Arts Museum, where you can see this sculpture, but actually in bronze, which is a little weird, but it's kind of cool because you can see her much closer than you can now in St. Peter's. So she writes this, Pietà is a work that illustrates Virgin Mary holding the body of Jesus after he was taken down from the cross. It's an in-the-round sculpture as to where it can be walked around it. It is also in the shape of a triangle, with Mary's hair pointing up high and her bottom being rather large. It is made of bronze, which meant there must have been a mold made before the made of the bronze one, so casting was involved. We were told in class about Mary's larger bottom half in order to sustain her son on her lap. To me, her larger bottom meant more. Once I saw it, I felt she was the roots that had made it all possible, and she had been there to support and sustain Jesus during his life, so that now she was being represented for what she was, his mother, a solid foundation. I think the purpose of this artist was to instill a kind of reaction and emotion, and it was achieved. I was raised in a strict Catholic home, so I find that all Catholic art affiliated to be somewhat scary, but at the same time mesmerizing and intriguing more than any other. It brings more emotion to me than any other. So she usually is scared, but she saw a mother, and I had a friend read this, and she was so angry she started correcting all of the mistakes, and then all of a sudden she gets to that part and her eyes just well up with tears. And this is where I see the sublime being carried, from the sculpture that was made in 1501 to, her name is Maria, actually, at Eastfield, to my friend Dana, who is welling up with tears. Of course, they're not the only ones that were touched by this work. I'll skip on because I have so many slides. So they're going to be a little few naked men as well. So here we have the Belvedere torso. This is a Greek sculpture, although my professors of the Sorbonne explained to me that everything that we know, bless you, absolutely nothing about the attributions of what was a Greek original, what was not. So Belvedere torso was around Michelangelo, bless you, at the time. And the Belvedere torso is what informed most of the nudes in the Sistine Chapel. They're all variations on the Belvedere torso, or Belvedere torso. Let's see. So here also Jonah, same thing. Okay, I'm going to skip. I'm sorry, I'm going to flip through because I have so many. I thought I'm going to use this as an example as a chance to show you images that you might not see. Obviously, you've seen these, but there'll be more of it. Okay, so, and then we have the Laocoon that was actually discovered when Michelangelo was working on the Sistine Chapel, and he is one of the artists who helped put it back together. So this was considered the height of Greek art at the time, Hellenistic art. And then, take a look at this figure right here. You see this figure, the sun? And this is another work of art that I think touches upon the sublime. So this is Michelangelo, and he, if you looked at that earlier figure, you can see that it's the same figure that inspired this work. And an artist I'll be speaking about at the end called Michael O'Keefe said he was in the Louvre walking around, and all of a sudden he felt as if someone had tapped him on the shoulder. There was no one there except for the dying slave. And he has carried this work with him all this time. So to me, this is where the sublime comes in, where it's something that that touches us in a way we can't explain and that we carry with us and that carries through. So, St. Teresa in ecstasy. I will skip over the Baroque, the Counter-Reformation, and we are looking at this very, very, very elaborate dramatic sculpture by Bernini, and it's a little over the top, one would say. When one sees it, one sees something quite over the top. The angel looks like he's Eros or Cupid. He does not look like an angel. He's got this naughty smile on his face. She's looking clearly like she's having an orgasm. And that's something that I would always, I would laugh at. And I do. She does look that way. Let's see if I can show up. So I don't know if you can see that better. So she is in ecstasy, which is, and I always remember the name on art history test that it's in Santa Maria della Vittoria because I always think it's a victory. She's had an orgasm. So that's how I remember. So just sharing that tip with you. So on that note, speaking of the sublime, Bernini, like Michelangelo, were very devout. They were very devout Catholics. And he actually created this work directly from her text, from her mystical experience, which I will read a little piece from.
If you just said something, I didn't hear what it was.
Was it orgasm? Sorry, okay, all right. It pleased our Lord that I should see the following vision a number of times. I saw an angel near me, on the left side in bodily form. This I am not wont to see, save very rarely. In this vision it pleased the Lord that I should see it thus. He was not tall but short, marvelously beautiful, with a face which shone as though he were as though he were one of the highest of the angels, who seemed to be all of fire. They must be those whom we call seraphim. I saw in his hands a long golden sphere, and at the point of the iron, there seemed to be a little fire. This I thought that he thrust several times into my heart, and that it penetrated to my entrails. When he drew out the sphere, he seemed to be drawing them with it, leaving me all on fire with a wondrous love for God. The pain was so great that it caused me to utter several moans, and yet so exceedingly sweet is this the greatest of pains that is impossible to desire to be rid of it, or for the soul to be content with less than God. So what touches me about this is I would encourage you to push past Freud and to go into Jung, because she does look like she's having an orgasm, she's having the best possible one, be united with the transcendent, right? And what I find fascinating in this work is that Bernini is able to articulate this idea of pushing pleasure to the point of pain, or having pain pushed to the point of pleasure. I've given birth, and I can tell you that I felt that with this, when you're feeling that your entrails are being ripped out. Anyway, so that would be another example of the sublime. Okay, maybe I should... How much time do we have? I haven't looked when we started.
You're fine.
Okay, just keep going.
Keep going.
Just so flash, okay. Same example with this other Bernini. That was, that's at the Villa Borghese. I think we need to go take a field trip. And he, Bernini, also illustrated a passage from Ovid. It's a long passage. I wish I could read you the whole, but... Okay, so Daphne is running away from Apollo, and she knows that if he catches her, she'll be his, and then she'll lose herself. So she's running away, and... Oh, there's a beautiful... Okay, I'll read you a little bit, just because there's such a wonderful passage. Apollo, would have said more, but the frightened maiden fled from him, leaving him with his words unfinished. Even then she was graceful, so to see, as the wind bared her limbs and its gusts stirred her garments, blowing them out behind her. Her hair streamed in the light breeze, and her beauty was enhanced by her flight. But the youthful god could not endure to waste his time on further banishment, and as love itself prompted, sped swiftly after her. Even so, when a Gallic hound spies a hare in some open meadow, he tries by his swiftness to secure his prey, while the hare, by her swiftness, seeks safety. The dog, seeming just about to fasten on his quarry, hopes at every moment that he has her, and grazes her hind quarters with outstretched muzzle. That's a great line. But the hare, uncertain whether she has not already been caught, snatches herself out of his very jaws and escapes the teeth which almost touch her. Thus the god and the nymph sped on, one made swift by hope and one by fear. But he who pursued was swifter, for he was assisted by love's wings. He gave the fleeing maiden no respite, but followed close on her heels, and his breath touched the locks that lay scattered on her neck. Still Daphne's strength was spent, and she grew pale and weary with effort of her swift flight. Then she saw the waters of Peneus. O father, she cried, help me! If your rivers really have divine powers, work some transformation and destroy this beauty which makes me please all too well. Her prayers were scarcely ended when a deep languor took hold of her limbs, and her soft breast was enclosed with a thin bark. Her hair grew into leaves, her arms into branches, and her feet that were lately so swift were held fast by sluggish roots, while her face became a treetop. Nothing of her was left except her shining loveliness. So you know the Apollo decides that he's going to make, because he still won't take no for an answer, so he's going to make the laurel tree be his tree, and that's why victors are crowned with laurel wreaths. What I think is just nice, you see how her hair is flowing, and I keep going back thinking there's a computer on the side. Here's the side view, and what I find magnificent is on this side, the bark will shoot up between his hands and her body. I may have a close-up, but I think I do. Let me see. Yes. So, do you see how she's crying out, and here, the thumb barely touches her belly, but the rest is, this bark is shooting up, right? So there's a pair, it's a pair, and the other one is the Wraith of Persephone, and I believe that Bernini was echoing that chaste hand with this one, with Bernini's Abduction of Persephone. So this one is a little bit shorter. So there it was, always spring, in this glade, Proserpine was playing, picking violets or shining lilies with childlike eagerness. She gathered the flowers into baskets and into the folds of her gown, trying to pick more than any of her companions. Almost at one and the same time, Pluto saw her and loved her and bore her off, so swift is love. So that's it. He just saw her, loved her, and bore her off. With wailing cries, the terrified goddess called to her mother and to her comrades, but more often to her mother. She rent and tore the upper edge of her garment till the flowers she had gathered fell from its loosened folds, and she was so young and innocent that even this loss caused her flesh distress. So, where does he answer with the hand? So this is one side, you could see the forward motion of carrying her off. And here is the hand. And I'll have some other close-ups, which is just sublime. And now he renders, it looks like a photograph, doesn't it? It's no one, but it's marble. And I see Bernini echoing, because they were conceived as a pair. So one chaste hand, one not so much. The Apollonian hand, the Dionysian hand. So going back, wait, the transition here, by the way, is flesh, just if you're wondering what's going on. So we have, this is one of my favorites. This is an altarpiece. It's by Caravaggio, also a Baroque artist, slightly different than Bernini. So this is an entombment, and you have people with dirty feet, dirty toenails, missing teeth, and an old Mary as opposed to the youthful virginal one. And you have Jesus being dropped into the tomb, which I think is fantastic, because where are we all here? We're in the tomb. Right? And he's heavy. It's a dead Christ. He's a heavy Christ. Yet he speaks to people that are against all religion, right? Because Jacques-Louis David, who was a neoclassical painter by par excellence, he was Louis XVI's official painter. And then he signed Louis XVI's death warrant. Then he became Napoleon's official painter. And so here we have in the first modern altarpiece to Marat. So he is a martyr, and he was killed in his tomb as he was riding. Thank you very much. Yes, Freudian slip. He was killed in his bath. Thank you very much. And this is something that truly happened. And Marat was a friend of David, so they knew one another. He was able to draw him his body dead, but he creates this modern altarpiece, and he downplays. There's a little bit of blood, but he downplays. What he really shows is this, almost this dead Christ. But in the revolution, you throw away all of the religion as you do the royalty. And so here you see that same limp hand that we saw. Obviously, Caravaggio knew the Pietà and had seen it. And David spent several years in Rome. As a painter of the king, having won the Prix de Rome, and so obviously knew these works. So now we're going to move over to a little bit of the darker side, because we have the sublime. We do talk about the sublime as there's that mystical experience, and even in St. Teresa, we have that pleasure, but there's also the pain. So this is work by Goya. That's called The Sleep of Reason Produces Monsters, and it's one that I have yet to understand. And I've asked specialists, and they were not able to explain it either. But I don't think that there is meant to be an explanation. I think it is that liminal space. It's an illustration or an image of that liminal space, that fear. This is another one. Fuseli is another. He was trained as a neoclassical artist. This is the nightmare. There's lots of different puns. It's illustrated for a lot of Freudian texts because there's several versions of this. And the goblin or the Mara, it could be the horse that's the mirror that, yes, looks like it's peeking out through a vagina. It does. It just doesn't happen to look that way. Then you've got the sensuality of her hair falling down. And then the fact that he or she is sitting right here. In other images, you see him sitting on her belly. So it's almost as if it were an erotic dream. Is she dead? Is she real? What is going on? So we're tapping into the unconscious, into the darkness that lies there. And here it's more fearful, one of losing oneself to that liminal space. Now we have another altar piece. This is one thing I really want to research more because I think it's so rich, is the German Romantics. This is Caspar David Friedrich. There is one in the Kimball. It's not this one. This was conceived, this is an altar piece. It was for a private chapel. And Friedrich created the frame along with the, and obviously we have, you know, the bread and the wine, we have the Trinity, we have the all-seeing God, and the cherubims, and then this is meant to be strength, and these trees are meant to be hope, like the strength of faith and hope. But as you can imagine, it was incredibly, it was attacked, and it was absolutely controversial because he is placing nature as the divine, as the altarpiece, and that's something that I'm fascinated with, is the panentheism, is finding the evidence of the transcendent in everything, which at our church, at the Unitarian Church, I see all the time. And so here's another painting by Friedrich that you probably have seen. A lot of philosophy texts use that as the cover. It's the wanderer above the sea of mist. It's again cryptic, mysterious, and Friedrich uses something that's used in cinema a lot. It's called a Ruckin figure. He places a figure in the center. He does it again and again. So it obstructs the center, and you don't see what he's looking at. So it serves several purposes. Well, you tell me. What do you see? What do you see when you see this?
The unknown.
The unknown? Yeah. And how about this guy right here? Do you identify with him? Do you want to step around him? Right here.
It looks like he's looking down instead of straight ahead. So he's not as open as it could be to me.
So perhaps he's looking within?
He's pensive.
Yep.
Mysterious.
Yes, please.
Is there a ship with people in it all to the right?
No, these are mountains. These are mountains. So it's not the sea. It looks like the sea, but it's probably just the mist rising from the cliffs. Yeah, but it's misleading. It's a little bit like Leonardo da Vinci in his Sfumato, where when you look at the background of the Mona Lisa, you're not sure, yes, what is what? Yes. Yes, or mysterious, I should say, mysterious. Yes, there's a saying I love, which is all stories are true, and some of them actually happened. So this is another one. This is the monk... A monk on the sea, and this is another Friedrich, and again, there's this figure there, and so some people may find it depressing, other enlightening, but it definitely doesn't leave you empty, or at least it leaves you searching into the emptiness, I guess, that is full, or that's the way I see it. Okay, so here's another, this is another one of my favorites. This is Gustave Moreau, who is a French 19th century, 20th century artist. This is one of his earlier works. It's Oedipus and the Sphinx. And Gustav Moreau uses a lot of, he's considered a symbolist. He's barely mentioned in art history text. But he had several students that you may have heard of at the Beaux-Arts. He was a teacher at the Beaux-Arts. Matisse, Henri Matisse is one of his students. Rouault is another one of his students. I don't know if you know him, but... And the other day, Frank Stella came to the Modern and spoke about the spaces in between in his work, his type of stripes where there's actually paint missing, and he credited Matisse for that and Matisse's Red Studio, but actually Matisse learned that from Moreau. So I'll show you a few more. This is an example of that. This is the Moreau painted Salomis. He was obsessed with her. He painted, I think, over 80, if not more. So here we have the apparition. He's completely taken the whole story and changed it to John the Baptist's head is now levitating. And you can see how he has, these are quite large canvases, and you can see how he scratched in just into the painting, because that way it makes it all the more rich. He's able to, some of them are much more layered.
And so is that bits of canvas or a base that we're seeing, the white?
The white, that's paint.
The scratches.
The scratches are, yes, he scratches in, yes, it's the canvas that you see, absolutely. Yes, he hasn't painted on top, he just goes straight into, because oil takes so long to dry, you can, yeah, thank you for asking. And then Renaud is another one of his students, and so Renaud exhibited with the Impressionists, and he also was inspired by, he's fascinating, he's also inspired by Goya. This is the head of Orpheus when it was found severed, and this head becomes very, very an inspirational motif. So and there's no specific, obviously it's classical, but he's more interested in this odd kind of nature in the back, and when I look at this, it makes me think of William Blake, another artist that we don't hear enough about, who was a prophet, but I'm going to work on getting him famous again. So still going with this idea of the Sphinx, we have the temptress, the sublime of the woman that will eat you and suck you dry. So here we have the Sphinx who's, I don't know if you can see, but her claws are digging inside of him. And I'm thinking this is probably not Orpheus, Oedipus, because he would not be surviving this. But this is Franz von Stuck, and we're deep in the symbolist time, which is where we really dive into the darkness of the sublime, and the fear of that, the fear of loss of control, the fear of loss of control in front of a woman, the fear of loss of control of one's sexuality. So this is another artist, Holder. This is Knight. It's actually his self. It's a self-portrait. And this pain just terrifies me. And if you notice this figure, I don't know who it is. I don't know if it's Knight. Is it death? Is it his fear of his own sexuality? I'm not sure. But notice how his legs are spreading. This figure, the succubus, is sitting smack on him, so. And then in case you weren't clear, you have this lovely butt right there. That's also sublime. So here is Newton by Blake. The colors are not as lovely as they are, so imagine more beautiful colors and think of the Rodin that we just saw. And Blake he wrote satirical work, he's a poet, as you know, and he is oftentimes misunderstood. But here, this figure of Newton, that we would think is maybe he's glorifying him. Do you see how he's got a compass? Or I'm not sure which that is. What is this tool? Compass. And then, of course, this looks like an Ionic column. So it's referencing order in Greece, and still to this day, if we want to show any kind of order inside of a building with order, we go back to the Greco-Romans. But really what he's showing here with this Newton that's figuring things out is one, he's completely oblivious to the miracle of nature and the beauty that he's just sitting on. And this the flora and the fauna and all of these microorganisms that he doesn't see, because he's too busy figuring things out and also splitting things into this is right and this is wrong. There's another image that's called the Ancient of Days, which is a white bearded man, and he's splitting things in two, and often people think, oh, that's God the Father, but actually it's not. He's actually splitting, and he's not a good, because he's showing this is right, this is wrong, which is not the way that Blake saw it. On that note, just finishing on this note, I love this idea of, the thing about Blake is that, you know, he has the songs of innocence and songs of experience, and oftentimes they're paired, you know, the lion and the lamb, and we want to see if this is good and this is bad, but actually, or maybe the innocence is better, what he is interested in is our going back to, we need to go through experience. It's not good to stay innocent. We need to go through experience and recreate, find a new innocence. A hope, perhaps, or a wonder. Still knowing. Okay, so I'll move forward. Obviously, Turner, this is one of his, this would be, if you say Sublime, one thinks of Turner. And this painting, forget exactly that, just said like wind and
steel.
Yes, something. Is that
one of the words in the
Yes, light. Yes, the rain, speed, steel, yeah. Something like that. I'm not sure. But when the critics saw this, which is completely, it's almost abstract. It's crazy that it was. And someone said that a critic said that he actually painted rain and speed, and he that's what he's creating in this painting. So this is Rite of Derby, and this artist is, do you see what's going on? Tell me what's going on. There's a bird. What's going on with the bird?
He's in a vacuum.
Yes. He's in a vacuum. Absolutely. So, and then what's, I forget what this is. I think it's something maybe to, so this is a, sorry?
It's like there's children being entertained.
Like yes.
Or horrified.
Well, the thing that's being, yes, one is absolutely horrified. It's a lesson. It's a lesson that's being given, and there's all these secrets. There's a secret society that they're showing you with the moon. But these are, their experiments are being constructed. But he's doing this, and it's a very large painting, which also informs the viewer to the importance of this art, is that it's grand scale, right? So it's a very large painting. But what he's doing is he's taking this technique taken from Caravaggio and the Baroque, where you have the light source in the center. Oftentimes you see this as a religious painting, but he's using it to show a scientific experiment where they're taking the air out of the pump, they're pumping the air out, so the bird is going to suffocate and then drop, hopefully they'll let air back in. And so he's explaining how it's working. You see how he's like pumping here, and here the father. So it's actually very progressive, because not only is it showing science, but then it's showing the education of these girls. And one of them is, and the father is reassuring and explaining, you have young women and a little girl. And so it's, and then of course we have Thomas Cole, and this is a cycle. I only have two images here, but he has this was during this American art, and he is showing, I wish I had the destruction. I just showed that this is the earlier kind of ideal time where you have, by the way, Stonehenge is in America, just so you can let you know, or in ancient Greece, I don't know exactly where this is. And then here we have the civilization that's gone a little too, are you seeing parallels with ours? That's gone a little too far, and then of course after this there's almost no plants left whatsoever. Everything's completely, we have some up here, but, and you can recognize the same landmarks. And then after that comes the deluge and the destruction, and then hopefully then the pastoral again. And you can't talk about the sublime without having churches, Niagara Falls. And so this is, when you talk about the sublime, you talk about, this was meant to be a patriotic painting. And it shows the greatness of America and also the danger of America. Because if you look at this, where are we standing? We're in the water. There's really no, and it's panoramic. And when John Ruskin saw this, he thought that it was lit from the back because it was so bright and powerful. And you can almost hear the rush. I think this is a very good example of this awe-inspiring fear. Okay, let me go. Okay, so because we talk about contemporary art, I can never remember the title correctly. Vir Heroicus Sublimis. So it is The Heroic Sublime by Barnett Newman. And we're supposed to stand 18 inches from it. So all you see is just the red. Is this super loud? And this is hurting my eyes, so I'm going to move forward to this one. That might give you an idea of scale. When I see this, the first thing I think about is a triptych, but there are several. So he, in that same idea, he creates these zips. He calls them zips. And they are meant to be for, this painting is meant for us to relate to this field of red. He wants us to have a sublime experience. He has very noble intentions. He's not doing this to make fun of us or anything like that. But I always go back to the classical thought, and I think these are like men or columns. It makes me think of Bernini and St. Peter's. And we relate to the space, and he wants us to relate to this not in a landscape that's horizontal, but to that space as a vertical. And to interact with that, with this redness. I'll let you tell me afterwards if you think. I wish I could have showed you videos. This is an artist who is, I think, a wise man to me. The first time I saw one of his works was at the Pompidou, and he scrapes pollen from one region, pure pollen, and just one kind of tree, and then he will spread it out on the floor. You see, I don't know if this is not a good image. It is pure pigment, just pigment, that he lays out. So his name is Wolfgang Leib, and if you can Google his name and look at videos, you hear the scratch, 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 and you can, and then that's what he's doing right now. He taps through a sift, and it's so meditative, and this is a smaller piece. He's done much larger pieces, and so to me, his work is sublime because it taps into this liminal space. Another artist, and this is where contemporary art in Dallas and in general right now is really into video art, and so it's hard to show you without showing you video art. But this one artist that I find tremendous is Bill Viola. The DMA has several of his pieces. So this is one piece that, on one side, you have him, and he's walking slowly. It's all very quiet. He's walking slowly, and lights come up as he walks, and then you see one drop of water, and then another drop, and then another drop, until it just completely showers him, and then he disappears. But the sound is so loud, just from that you can feel your body tremble with it. And then on the other side is the same thing, but with a flame of fire at his feet, and then it just grows and grows and grows. So this is an artist, this is a student of mine at UD, and so you have to look at the titles too. He did, so at UD I asked my students to be inspired by work, if they're inspired by work of art, if they are, I asked them, instead of writing yet another term paper, because they're MFA students, to create some works that have something to do with what we've studied, in this case, Baroque art. That's what he was in that class. He got in, he finished his MFA last semester. And do some pieces. So he did several, and of the works that we've seen, I use these two. But he does little cartoon figures, and he plays a lot. And I think that these are very clever. And to me, this is an example of how art continues, because at first it's silly, so we, but he has the pixelated art is very much in now, drives me crazy, but, so you have the pixelated version of St. Teresa, you can see the rays right here, and then here you have her, this is Myth of Hedbetter, and this is titled, Not the Not-So-Ecstatic St. Teresa. So it's silly, and she has still her shoes, but this time she actually has shoes on her feet. She's not, I guess she's of the slipper order as opposed to the barefoot order. And then this one, it says, we can still make this work, babe. And it's called App and Daft, Living on a Foot Prayer. What's interesting about this is that first she looks very unhappy, and she's totally a tree. But this tool that he's incorporated is a tool that Bernini used to create the all of the intricacies. And so I really appreciate that he's paying attention. So it's at first it looks silly, but actually there's research. And
it's also a phallic.
It is very much a phallic. Thank you very much. Thank you. Have you been in my class? Thank you. So where this leads us now is that this is a work by, these are very large, they're 10 foot, I think. I work at Conduit Gallery, it's one of my several jobs, and it's in Dallas. And this is, I'm going to show you a few, or this work by an artist that we have. It's called Evidentia, this one, and she took photos of a river. She was canoeing on a river, and she took photos. So she's painting a photo of the water that's reflecting the sky, if you can see that. So she has several pieces that are like that, and this one you may see the tree. Some of them you don't see quite as much, so you're thinking you're seeing just an abstract work. And then once I tell you, then you start seeing. And this spoke to me because as a child, that was my favorite thing to do in Paris, was walk on the black sidewalks and look at the reflection of the sky. And I would imagine that I was walking on water. I don't know if you've had that experience before. And so she, when I was talking to her, I said, you're painting this liminal space. It's somewhere in between, and these are very large, speaking of scale, they're very large, so you walk into them. Just because we're talking about contemporary art, I thought I would show Jeff Koons, who in his new, I guess it's not, it's 2013, he took every single Greek classic that we can think of, and stuck those gazing balls on them. And so it's just a cast, so we have the Belvedere torso again, right, recognize him. And then we have a kneeling Aphrodite or crouching Venus or whatever. And then he's using the blue that Jeff Koons uses, which I didn't talk about. But so I just think it's plastic and silly and not doing anything good. But this is another artist that's from Dallas, and he exhibits at the Valley House. His name is Michael O'Keefe, and I was lucky enough to get to write the intro to one of his catalogs. And this is one of his pieces. So he works in bronze and in plaster. And then here's another one. So it's a piece of plaster. But contrarily to Jeff Koons, I think that he captures the essence of the ancient Greeks in this. You see the sway. And in our exchanges, this is what came out. And I thought this was quite apropos for this talk. I told him, I see your assembled fragments as whispers that once united by your hands create a piece as old as time, touching the height of classical Greece and early Hellenistic. And he wrote, do you know that type of whisper where someone whispers something in your ear and you can't really make out the exact words, but their closeness, their presence, their energy, their breath, their warmth, seem to be enough to communicate the content of the whisper even when the words are inaudible? A powerful image needs only whisper in this way, needs not words, has no words, but rings true. And I think that's a good definition of the sublime. And I think that may be my last one. Thank you very much. Do you have any questions or?
I'm gonna do that for you.
Okay.
But first of all, we want to present you a little thank you for being a featured speaker.
Yay.
And as a little
is there Raphael?
That's Raphael. Okay, that's sublime too.
Yes, he is. Thank you so much. Thank you. I love it. Oh, thank you.
And also as a token of our appreciation, we'd like to donate $25 to a charity of your choice, or if you don't have one, the Dallas Philosophers Forum has a scholarship fund for budding philosophy.
Okay, let's do that.
Graduate students. You want to do that?
Yes, that sounds wonderful. Okay, yes, we need more philosophy, more poets.
And more artists.
Or do we need more poets? Okay.
Okay, questions? Yes.
Yeah, one thing I haven't heard you address specifically.
Yes.
I think you're playing fighting kind of both ways. Is how objective sublimity is, or whether something can be sublime for someone, for one viewer or not for another viewer.
Yes, absolutely. One thing, this is not exactly answering your question, but one thing that frightens me is the use, how we use words. I meant to talk about that, how like the word awesome, or it's actually the same root as awful, right? To be filled with awe. But how many of us use the word awesome, like, oh, awesome, and that's it. So yes, I agree absolutely with you. The sublime is not, I think it touches, and this is why I love teaching art history, is I think that something that's going to speak to someone is not going to speak to someone else, and we need it all. But there are certain things that if we, sorry to quote the Bible, but if we have the eyes to see and ears to hear, it'll touch us. Something like Michelangelo. And another one of my exchanges with Michael when I was doing a talk at UD, I said, well, how do I express the sacred within the profane? That's another something I'm interested in. And I said, how do I help them see? And he said, you lock them in a room for 5 hours with a Rembrandt self-portrait. And I said, well, I don't have that time. I have 40 minutes. But I think a lot of the times when I'm teaching art history, I think my job is just to ramble at the students long enough that they stare at these images and then something comes through, you know?
Have you had dreams of the art that you've seen?
In other words, have you had dreams of the art that really has touched you the most? Have you had dreams? Has this impacted you in your
In my dreams, dreams? No. I've had dreams of artists that have touched me. I mean, just in my dreams. No, not that I can think of. It's funny. One of the dreams I have is with Molly a lot, actually, where we walk through Paris. That's one dream that I have again and again, where we're just walking through Paris. So not in front of art per se, but just in the streets. So one day we'll get to do that, I guess, maybe. But I've had works where something will just like sucker punch me, and then maybe later it won't. How about you?
Well, I've had dreams mostly where I maybe listen to a musical artist, and in the dream I would actually hear a song that they've never written before performed by that artist. So where did that come from?
Oh, well, I have my theories, but I don't know if you want to hear this.
I'm just saying that's kind of strange to hear a song from somebody in their style that they've never published, but you hear it in their dream.
Can you contact that person? And I think you need to tell something.
Is it a creation of the song? Yeah, where did that creation come from?
From within yourself.
Well, there you go. Yes, absolutely. You're in yourself. That's what I mean, like I said, I'm a big fan of Carl Jung, so I believe that there's great mystery and that we have access to it if we allow it. I think so, and I think that's what's happening in your dreams.
Well, I'm just wondering if that had ever happened where you see art that is reminiscent in your dreams of another artist.
No, actually, that's a really good question. No, not exactly that. I've had interactions with artists, but not that at all. Good question.
Thank you.
question.
Well, there's a lot on your talk there.
Yes, there's a lot of talk.
It touched me. It was great, I thought. I kind of research as a hobby space weather and certainly things along that line. And the James W. Turner image, which I didn't ever remember seeing, struck me at the time of his age when there were gray clouds that fell over England and Europe, and it became very cold. Also, the Venus, the winged,
the Nike.
Yeah, and then the other one at the end,
The lady, oh, I don't think I had the title. Her name is Lady Classical. The one that looks like a piece, just a piece of almost abstract. Lady Classical is her name.
No, it's a statue. Well, there is an object that is called a co-rotating, or co... It follows the same orbit of the Earth around the Sun, only at a different speed. And so the Earth and it meet up 200 years or so apart, every 2 years. And then there's a period of time when people see it. Well, one of the last times it was I'm terrible at listening. The writer who did the Black Monk.
Oh, Friedrich.
That was Friedrich.
Yes. Friedrich.
A different Friedrich. Okay, well, the Intermediate Theater did a play called The Black Monk.
Oh.
And a friend said, I want you to come see this play and tell me what this thing is in this play.
Can you make a question out of this?
I'm getting it. I have to educate birds. So I went and looking at this play and this figure appears, and I had to go read the play afterwards because it describes what I had just been reading about, which is a satellite. Every 90 minutes they would see this object, which had not been seen for a while. And they had reports of it from all over the world. Slow reports, and then I came back. Well, we're beginning to have this again, and it looks just like that. And the way the sun catches it, or the light from the moon reflects off of it, or even the earth shine reflects off of it, can give it a completely different
aura,
vision, actually. Like you might see the wings, if you're in light from one direction, just straight line figure from another direction. I just wanted to say thank you for that.
Thank you.
For that connection for me, because it's the mind, and people see it now and they have all kinds of things, but very few people have connected it to the historic art of these objects.
Well, look at German romantics in general, and Caspar David Friedrich, he did a lot of these atmospheric paintings, yeah, the German romantics, yes.
You tell me more about it later.
I will. I would love to do that.
See if there's anybody else.
When I was at the Vatican, we were on tour, and they said that Michelangelo only completed 10% of what he... That was hard for me to fathom. He must have worked night and day.
He felt that the sculptures needed to be, some of them needed to be completely freed and some of them did not. But he did, I'm sure he did work night and day, and he worked until the day he died. He kept, it was actually a type of pietà that he did. Yes?
He was nearly 90.
Yes.
Can I say something about
Please, please, yeah, because I'm not a specialist on
Michelangelo. Yeah, just about the Agony and the Ecstasy, read it, because it's a fascinating book, over 800 pages, but he lived a long life. He worked until he was nearly 90. His father died on his 90th birthday as well. But part of why he didn't finish stuff was political, because he would get these commissions from rich people, and he would promise them a date, and then the Pope would come along and say, drop that, you're doing this for me. So he got all his work back up, and that was the main problem why he didn't finish stuff.
Yeah, he didn't really want to do the last judgment.
But the Pope says you do it, and you don't have a whole lot of choice.
Yeah, that's
With Michelangelo, his earlier works are very, very polished and perfect, and then toward the end, they are unfinished, and it looks like the figure's trying to pull off some of the marble and emerge from it. My question is, how much of the art of the sublime part of it is subjective to the artist, and how much is he trying to portray or project to his audience?
Okay, I don't know if I'm going to answer this. I feel like a politician because you're asking my question. I'm going to answer over here, but I feel that's something I want to write about, is that liminal space between the artist and the model, or that liminal space that we enter in when we create. And Matisse spoke about this, that he never believed in God, but that when he's working, that he is in connection. And I'm not saying, don't quote me on those words, but he never believed in God. He doesn't believe in God, but when he's making art, he is connected in a way. That's my words, not his. And there is something, when I draw nudes, there's a moment where I'm no longer paying attention to the model or my paper. I'm just somewhere in the middle. You enter into that. And I know my mother's a painter, and I know so many times she doesn't listen to herself, and she just keeps pushing and pushing and pushing, and she screws up a whole painting. She's got to wipe it down, start over again. And so I think, speaking about the higher self, I think that someone like Michelangelo probably didn't have internet, so he was probably able to tap into his higher self or more deeply and know when he needed to finish it, when he needed to leave it. The David by Michelangelo, that giant one, had already been pre-drilled. It was almost a throwaway, and he knew that he could pull that out of it. So does that answer your question at all?
Sort of.
I don't need a mic, it's fine. Okay. I just said, in your mind, is there a period of art that you did go all over?
Yes.
In a good way. That's more sublime that someone could focus in on and look at that period as a whole.
Oh.
In your mind, I mean, again, this is...
I think there's so many artists... I was thinking there's so many contemporary artists that could fit, but if you're asking my taste, I want to write about, and I asked John if there were classes at UD on this. I want to study the mystics, mm-hmm. And there was a time, the German Romantics, apparently I was there in my previous life, we looked at nature mysticism, and we looked at a mystic called Jakob Burma and Kozengarten, and they believed in the book of nature. It was not believed in, but that you can see an evidence of God in the Bible, and you can also see an evidence of God in nature. And so my dream is to study that more. So if you're asking, and I actually didn't even show really any other than Friedrich, I didn't show any of the guys that I want to talk about. They are guys that I want to talk about. One is named Runge. And he, Philip Otto Runge, and he thought that landscape was the new religious painting. And so he has figures in it, but it has to do with alchemy, it has to do with all of that. And then another thing that we don't talk about, that I don't know if that has anything to do with that, is the importance of the occult and theosophy in art. In the 19th century that I was showing with, but also in the 20th century. But we just, because people like performance artists and Gwendolyn Klein, he was a very high decorated Rosicrucian, if that's a term. And so they looked at all of the occult and in theosophy and all of that. But we just don't talk about it in our history classes. I don't know why. Because it hasn't been in fashion, or I don't know what it was, but I want to talk about it.
It goes against the Spanish Inquisition.
Perhaps, but see, St. Teresa, I mean, she...
Well,
yeah.
Lord of Marsh,
yes. That is weird.
Very weird.
Yes, he was definitely... He was a surrealist that just got bumped back a few hundred years. Yeah.
Do you think that the Sublime is a goal for many artists these days? And
that's a good question.
And where do you think art is headed?
Wow, okay. I do not know. I will tell you this. I've been working at a gallery, and I'm in the art world now, and some of it I just, excuse me for my swearing, a lot of time I want to say, what the fuck is this? And that's just, yeah, but... And then I also think that it's important to know how to make something. And when you teach art history, all of these abstract artists, like you start with Picasso, though he was never an abstract artist and he was against abstract art, interestingly enough. He would break away the figure, have shifting, but it was not, it was figurative. But he knew how to paint, like, and so I'm very classical. I think you, and I know a lot of abstract artists that still go back to the figure, they just, because proportion. But in answer to your question, I don't have an answer to that question. I'm scared when I think of how we want immediacy. And other conversations I've had with artists, it's a lot of times it looks flat. If something's painted from a photograph, it looks flat. Like it has no soul. And I think... Yes, and I think people may, because we don't take the time. I don't know. I don't think we can say it's heading in this direction. But I know, for an example, I don't know if y'all followed the is it the Emperor Has No Balls or the yes, you know what I'm talking. Okay, so all right, so it's some.
I wish that was.
So some statues of Donald Trump have been, or supposedly looking slightly like Donald Trump, have been erected, I hate to use that word, around in different cities. And I think he, and so he has a belly, and I think he has no testicles, I think. He has a little bitty penis and on these. And then, No, I'm not. It's not politics. I'm just describing a sculpture. But I was talking with some of my artist friends. I was thinking they look poorly made. They don't look like Donald Trump. And also, to me, the artist is quoting the Rodin's Balzac. That was very polemical because people thought he was masturbating underneath his robe. I don't know if you've seen. He's like this. But no, I'm thinking the artist probably doesn't even know that. And that, as an art historian, makes me mad. Because if Rodin did it better, then I don't know. Anyway, I just think make it better.
Did you see the quote the New York Art Department made about the statue of Lincoln Airport?
No, I did not.
It's awesome. It's an email. I'll send it to you.
Okay, yes, I would love that. Yes.
Yeah. One more question? Well, I have one. Partly from what I said before, that there's a couple of ideas or theories or whatever, why an artist paints a certain thing. One is an author he's aware of an audience. He's aware that he's painting for somebody just to look at. And the other artist says, I don't care what you see, I want to put my impression, my whatever I'm feeling into this. I don't care about whatever you see in it or not. What do you think about those two?
I think no matter what we do, it's always about ourselves. And I had a conversation with an artist saying, you know, that this looks a lot like, it looks a lot like me. And I said, two people have asked me if that was an image of me. And he said, but, and he was bewildered. He said, but they're not about you. They're not about you. And they're about a lot of things. And I looked at him and I said, I know, they're about you. It's all about, you know, it's this idea of the animus or the anima, and we're all, or at least in Jungian terms. And it's all about them, I think.
Thank you.